Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is United States against Serna. Ms. Tom.
May it please the court, counsel. The primary issue advanced for Raymondre Serna is the unjustified disparity between his 15-year sentence and virtually every other defendant in his case in front of Judge Dara and the companion case in front of Judge Cannelli. Mr. Serna was penalized in every way possible while being denied the benefit of any opportunity of leniency. He is distinct from every co-defendant who cooperated, as he did. He alone was denied substantial assistance. It's our view that his 15-year sentence in the context of this case is indefensible, particularly in light of certain co-defendants with, for example, similarly high criminal history categories, who received vastly shorter sentences that couldn't be justified by any slight difference
counsel,
in their conduct.
As you're aware, we've said repeatedly that the disparity clause in the statute deals with the way different districts treat similar crimes, not with the way the same judge treated different defendants in the same case. And yet your argument seems to be focused only on the line of disparity that we've said is no good. Why should we disregard our precedents?
Judge, my view of your precedents is a little different. In United States versus Campbell, which came out in August of 2011, the court remarked that Section 3553 does permit district courts to reduce one defendant's sentence because of another's lenient sentence. Also, this court in United States versus Statham said disparity among judges and districts and co-defendants. So, Judge, I believe that under 3553, this court can look at the severity of one defendant's against the leniency of another.
I think you are mistaking two words, can and must. You seem to be saying that everything a district judge can do, the district judge must do, because the judge didn't do it. You're asking us to reverse. And these are fundamentally different concepts.
I believe that this disparity warrants reversal because it's an unreasonable sentence. Let's just look at whether it's a reasonable sentence in light of itself. We can compare the others, which I've done, and I believe that the vast differences between them makes the sentence unreasonable.
Well, this fellow was given a break on the last time he violated the law, and he got deported, and he came right back and used the same credentials to get back in he used before.
As did most of these defendants in this case, or shall I say many, got deported or left and came back to commit this fraud. And
well, maybe their sentences ought to be bigger then. I don't know.
I can't see that as the issue before us now. That's done. That's
well,
water,
you're
that's
talking
water
about
under
disparity.
The bridge.
There are various ways to correct disparity.
Well, let me just point out to one defendant in front of Judge Cannelli, Mr. Toder. So he's another district court judge. Mr. Toder originally got 96 months. This court reversed based on loss amount analysis. And when he went back on resentencing, he got 72 months. So 6 years. Mr. Toder was a manager. Mr. Toder was in the scheme 6 months longer. Mr. Toder didn't cooperate or assist. Mr. Toder collected proceeds from two states in addition to Illinois. Mr. Serna did not. Mr. Toder opened accounts to money launder. Mr. Serna did not. So what we have is 72 months versus 180 months. The thing about this case is that local participants, Chicago participants, really all shared the same roles and often engaged in indistinguishable conduct. And they, compared to Mr. Cerna, were treated much more lenient. And I, probably one of the most disturbing things is the substantial assistance that Mr. Cerna gave. And he's the only one.
That was presumably fairly useless. The government couldn't call him as a witness, right?
No.
He'd cooperated in the past, committed on the gotten a 5K1 break before, right? Gets deported, comes back again, as Judge Cudahy pointed out. This is a guy who would be pretty tough to use as a witness in a trial, wouldn't he?
No, I don't agree, and I don't think any good attorney would take their client in for proffers if there wasn't the chance that he would testify or have substantial assistance.
I'm talking about the prosecutor's view, not the defense attorney's view.
No, the prosecutor's view never was they weren't going to use them. If they had said those words, nobody would have brought him in. My predecessor in the case and myself. So I respectfully disagree that he wouldn't be good. He was the top of the food chain. And this district uses the top of the food chain.
That's a different problem, right?
No, not in this district. Top of the food chain is preferred these days because they eat up the little fish. They know everything. The government says he was at the top of the food chain. Let me correct that. I'm not sure he was, and I'll stand on my arguments in my brief. But this is a person who the government never represented he would not be used at trial. And my understanding is, to this day, it's because they didn't arrest the Romanians. Well, the other people who cooperated, they didn't arrest the Romanians either. So I believe that that is a problem in the case in the lower court. There were varying differences here and there between defendants, the 20 or so defendants, but it still didn't explain his almost 3 times greater sentence than Mr. Toter, 4 times greater than Mr. Schneider, who, by the way, had a criminal history 4, and 2 times greater than Mr. Vega, who had a criminal history 5, just like Mr. Cernas. So
part of the problem here is that, you know, many people in the federal criminal justice system chafed under mandatory guidelines for many years and wanted additional flexibility and individualized sentences. We have them now. We have greater flexibility, and a fairly predictable result of that is greater individual disparities among defendants, right? So the question is how tightly we should try to review very discretionary decisions by district judges.
In this particular case, these were guideline sentences.
Mm-hmm. So he got a guideline sentence.
Yeah, he got a guideline sentence.
And we're supposed to hold that unreasonable.
In this circumstance, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Were the others guideline sentences?
Yes. Except for Judge Cannelli gave Toter on the first sentencing a below guideline because he said, he talked about the disparity. I'm going lower.
So the position here, though, is that the guidelines produce unreasonable disparities.
The guidelines for Mr. Cerna, we're required to look under 3553 individually at each defendant. For Mr. Cerna, this disparate treatment was unreasonable, and I'd ask you to reverse. I see my red lights on.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Barker.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is James Barton, and I represent the other co-appellant in this matter, Mr. Marion Alexandru. Your Honors, the sole consideration for the Court this morning is whether the District Court erred in failing to consider Mr. Alexandru's argument in mitigation of his sentence based on the 18-month delay between his arrest and indictment for the instant offense. In United States v. Cunningham, this Court stated that a District Court at sentencing who fails to consider an argument of recognized legal merit is likely to have considered an error or oversight. 4 years after Cunningham was decided, this court stated in United States versus Villegas Miranda that a defendant who advances an argument that prosecutorial delay foreclosed that defendant from serving concurrent sentences is in fact an argument of recognized legal merit. This is precisely the case we have before this court. As the pre-sentence investigation report at 12 indicates, Mr. Alexander was arrested on...
I don't know how you say the district judge ignored the argument. I mean, elsewhere in your brief, you say the district judge foreclosed you from pursuing it because the judge said, well, I understand you, but I'm not going to do anything about that. I mean, how is that ignoring an argument? It just sounds like an adverse decision.
Well, Judge Easterbrook, if you take a look at the appendix at page 48, which initially reflects the initial portion where Mr. Alexander's counsel sought to advance the argument, it's clear that the court initially considered two facets of that argument. First, whether Mr. Alexander's sentence for illegal reentry was discharged, and second, whether the time Mr. Alexander spent in state custody on his possession of unlawful identification charge warranted that the sentencing court for the state court issued a probationary sentence. However, these considerations missed the mark, Your Honor. And if you turn to the appendix at page 66, it's clear that Mr. Alexander's counsel sought to realign his focus for the argument and specifically stated that, and I quote, all I'm saying, Judge, is that according to the record I've been able to review and the documents, that he, Mr. Alexander, was being held in Florida on the ID charge because of the investigation here for the bigger charge. And in response to that question, Your Honor, the court stated, what evidence do you have of that? Turning to the appendix at page 67, Mr. Alexander's counsel, at the behest of Mr. Alexander, then proffered that evidence, specifically the Homeland Security report, which is found in the record at page 182-1, and also in the appendix beginning at page 118. Now, this report, Judge Easterbrook, documents Mr. Alexander's arrest and the subsequent investigation initiated by the government. When the appendix at page 118 is read in conjunction with the appendix at page 125, it's clear that Mr. Alexander's September 7, 2005 arrest was specifically predicated on the government's investigation of the instant offense. Moreover, the appendix at page 130 indicates that 2 weeks after Mr. Alexander's arrest, the government authority subpoenaed Western Union.
I'm still lost. You're arguing the facts to me, and arguing the facts to an appellate court is a complete waste of time. And you haven't addressed my question, which is you started by blaming the district judge for not addressing the defense argument. It looks to me like the judge did address it, and he said, it's a bad argument. I'm not reducing the sentence on that account. Now, you may agree or disagree with that. It now sounds like you're disagreeing with it, but I don't understand how it's possible to say the judge ignored it.
Your Honor, if you turn to the appendix at page 67, in response to Mr. Alexander's counsel's argument, where he initially stated why he felt his belief that Mr. Alexander was held based on the larger investigation, the court asked, what evidence do you have of that? And when Mr. Alexander's counsel sought to proffer that evidence, the court ignored it. It's quite clear if you continue reading down the appendix at page 67 that the court simply disregarded the evidence, realigned it, stated the record before me doesn't support what you asked for, realigned its focus back to the loss amount, noted the hour was getting late, and sentenced my client.
And also noted at the same page that the defendant had been arrested and was immediately charged with a federal crime that he ultimately was convicted of, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. But Judge Hamilton, the charges that Mr. Alexander was charged with based on his September 7, 2005 arrest were part and parcel of the overarching instant offense. As the government's version of the offense indicates at page 48 and 49, the possession of unlawful identification charge was considered part of Mr. Alexander's relevant conduct. Moreover, the district court acknowledged on page 27 and 75 of the record that Mr. Alexander re-entered the country illegally to reinitiate participation into the scheme. Thus, all of these charges were inextricably linked. And had Mr. Alexander been charged and indicted with wire fraud at the time of his arrest, he would have had the opportunity to serve concurrent sentences pursuant to the sentencing guidelines under 5G1.3.
It sounds like you're asserting the government has an obligation to schedule these different arrests and prosecutions in a way to maximize the chances for a low sentence?
Your Honor, what I'm specifically stating, Judge Hamilton, is this, that based on, obviously, the government, I'm not saying based on the record here before us that the government had some nefarious purpose in waiting to charge Mr. Alexander. Obviously, given the size of the case and its complexity, the government had to take some time to get its ducks in a row to charge and indict Mr. Alexander and 20 of his co-defendants. But that said, this 18-month delay foreclosed Mr. Alexander the possibility of serving concurrent sentences. And if you turn to the First Circuit's 1997 decision in Saldana, which is found on page 25, footnote 6 of our opening brief, it states, even a careless or innocent delay can produce sentencing consequences so unusual and unfair that a departure would be permissible. Thus, based on this 18-month...
I don't understand that, I must say. I can see a concern if the defendant is sentenced to a mandatory minimum, part of which might have received credit through a concurrent sentence. Your client wasn't sentenced to a mandatory minimum, so no matter how much time he had spent in prison before, the judge could say, okay, you've spent that time in prison before, I'm going to give you a year off. Or the judge could say, I think that time in prison is for something completely different. I need to preserve marginal deterrence. I'm giving you an extra year, even if the sentences had been concurrent. So everything is within the judge's power to adjust. Is there any particular reason why concurrent sentences would matter when the judge can adjust up or down within these bands?
Well, Judge Easterbrook, I see my time is done. May I have leave to finish your question?
Once we're talking, you can talk.
Thank you. if this court stated in United States versus Villegas Miranda, the policy guidelines of 5G1.3 dictate that the purpose of concurrent sentences is to prevent a defendant from serving duplicative sentences for what essentially amounts to the same criminal act. And here, there can be no dispute that the charges with which he was ultimately charged were part and parcel of this wire fraud scheme. And as a result of that, the district court's failure to consider whether Mr. Alexander should have received a mitigated sentence under 3553A warrants that this court vacate Mr. Alexander's sentence and remand for resentencing with the specific instructions. Thank you.
Ms. Greenwald.
Your Honors. Beginning with Mr. Cerna's argument, the district court fully considered defendant Cerna's argument about disparity. It concluded that there was no unjustified disparity because he was a criminal history category 5, unlike many of the other defendants who were only 1. He had a greater offense level, not just based on being a manager supervisor, but as to many defendants based on the loss involved. And as to substantial assistance, the government had said to the court that its position as to Cerna, given his prior having been given a 5K departure in a prior case and then having not disclosed to the government at that time that he had a fraudulent passport and then, in fact, using that passport to return to the United States and commit further fraud in this case, that given that position, that given that conduct, they would not be making a substantial assistance reduction unless they could charge the foreign co-conspirators, which they weren't able to do. So they did not make that motion. And the court, in sentencing the defendant, agreed with that assessment, essentially, finding that his prior conduct...
I understood your opponent to say that other defendants here did the same thing, right? Same history, is that?
Not the same history as to prior 5K, having received a 5K.
Well, I may have misunderstood the answer.
No. He is the only defendant that I'm aware of on this record that had a prior 5K and then turned around while they had that 5K and were giving that cooperation.
Pardon? 5K is a whole subpart of the guidelines.
Right.
You mean 5K 1.1?
Thank you, Your Honor. Having had that, having been providing that assistance, then going on and committing further crimes and not having disclosed possession of a fraudulent passport to the government. He was unique as to that. As to Toter, this defendant, like defendant Toter, had in fact collected loss from two other states, had in fact had other co-defendants open accounts to run money through, to run Western Union checks through in connection with this crime. He was very similar to defendant Toter, and they both received manager and supervisor enhancements. But he, unlike defendant Toter, had a Category 5, not a Category 1. He, unlike defendant Toter, had a much higher loss amount involved. And in addition, defendant Toter was sentenced to less by Judge Kennelly because he also had an illness that the judge took into account, which was not the case with Mr. Cerna. So in short, this defendant was very different and came before the court with a significant criminal history, a significant participation in this offense. And the judge, well within his discretion, found the sentence not to be an unjustified disparity. As to Mr. Alexandru, in his opening brief, Mr. Alexandru argued that he had been precluded from raising a Villegra-Miranda argument to the court. Taking that at its value, that he had been precluded, and basically agreeing that he had not raised a Villegra-Miranda argument to the court, the government responded that, in fact, he had not raised such argument. He had not been precluded from it. The court gave him repeated opportunities to make arguments, and that, in fact, he had waived that argument. Whether he waived it or not, whether he presented it, whether this delay argument that he's making, that he made to the court below, captures what he's arguing on appeal now, the bottom line is, as you have noted, the judge did address that argument and addressed it on the merits.
The judge rejected the position, but here's my trouble.
Yes.
I can't tell whether the judge meant, I won't reduce your sentence, or whether he meant, I can't reduce your sentence. Now, if he meant I won't reduce your sentence, that's reviewed for abuse of discretion. If he meant I can't reduce your sentence, that's wrong.
Yes, I would agree.
Which of these do you think he meant, and how do we know that that's right?
He absolutely meant I won't, not I can't, because a couple of times on the record, and I will try and find them for you, Your Honor, he says, I do understand that I can do it on this ground. Mr. Mitchell.
Where are you?
I know. I'm going to find it for you, Your Honor. And if I don't find it now, with the court's permission, I will submit a letter to you providing you with those pages.
That would be fine.
Okay. Because he does say it.
It certainly matters here.
Let me see if I can find it, Your Honor, because he definitely – actually, I have some notes on that. That he can give him credit. What he was concerned about.
At the microphone, talking back and forth doesn't get recorded properly.
What he does say is that what he's clear on is he didn't want to give him credit twice. His concern, and I will get that page for you, but his concern, the judge's concern was that the state court and the federal court sentencing him on the reentry may have already taken into account in its sentences that he'd been in custody. And it was, and he did not want to give this defendant credit twice for that time in custody. And Your Honors, arrested. Nothing to show the time. Okay, it's at page 49 of the record, and the judge says...
49 of the record? It must be
49 of the transcript.
I think it's page 55 of the appendix.
Of the appendix 55, yes, Your Honor. He says... the government says... And for the sake of today's proceedings, you can certainly consider it again. In other words, the judge is saying maybe the Florida court already considered that he'd been held in custody, and that's why they gave him 10 months rather than 19 months. And the government says, and for the sake of today's proceedings, you certainly can consider it again. There's nothing under 3553. And the court says, I absolutely agree with that. But the equities that you're asking me to consider is that he sat in custody and won't get any credit for. That's what I think you're arguing or asking me to give credit for that. And my question is, do we know that he wasn't already given credit for it? So the court expressly says, I know I can consider that, but I'm telling you that I'm not going to give him credit twice. This isn't a defendant who deserves credit twice for that time. And moreover, Your Honors, he then, I mean, there's about 10 or so pages in the record where he's considering, I mean, not in the record, in the transcript, where he's considering this argument. And at the end of the day, I believe that he does absolutely consider it to the extent it's raised and rule on it by saying that when they point to that Homeland Security report, the court responds. After discussing it for a couple of lines, he says, the record before me does not support what you ask for. So it was addressed on the merits to the extent the argument was raised, considered by the court, and the court later on in the record goes on repeatedly and asks the defense counsel, do you have anything else you want to raise? And defense counsel, far from feeling that he couldn't raise things with the court, does make additional arguments. But he never comes back to this argument and presses it again on the court or further elaborates on it or says, you didn't get my point, Your Honor. You didn't let me develop it. In fact, he then moves on to other things. So the record before this court and that transcript in particular fully supports the government's position, which that is that this argument was waived, and if it wasn't waived, it was sufficiently considered and there was no error here. Unless the court has any other questions. Would rest on our brief.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.